side too.
I'm a practicing Jew. She is not a convert. She is an Episcopalian and is actively religious in her own right, although neither of us really is deeply involved in services. This is about as much
there are no traditional practices in your home at all?
No. There are not. And of course, that's interesting given my background and my involvement in the community and my involvement in the hospital. Although I'm deeply committed to Judaism, I have to say that was reinforced for me in the service. There was so much anti-Semitism in the service that I encountered that it just reinforced for me my values. You know, I believe in Judaism. I believe it's a system of justice. I think has more of a social and philosophical meaning to me than a religious meaning. I know I'm Jewish. I know when I die, I'll be buried on a Jewish cemetery. My wife and I have discussed that because I've talked about whether we should be buried together. She, of course, practices her own religion. The likelihood is she'll be buried somewhere else, although she says she has no particular concern where she is. But I just have identified over the years, I think because of my father and all the reactions that I had to what went on with regard to him, that I'm Jewish. I know that. I know that I don't have to go to services to be aware of that. I'm a great supporter of Israel. I believe in Israel. Although I've not visited there, but I've been a major contributor to Federation in Israel. I believe in Jewish values.
You have you lived in a Jewish neighborhood always?
Well, Oakland, where we lived, was a mixed neighborhood. There were a lot of Jews in Oakland, but it was a real melting pot, which was another interesting experience for me. Although I had lots of Jewish friends, Oakland was primarily made up of Middle Europeans, the Irish, and the Jews, and the Italians, and it was a real melting pot. It's only in recent years that it's become very few Jews are left in Oakland, and it is becoming a much more mixed black type neighborhood.
Have you been politically active in any way?
Only in conjunction with the work that was done, that I did at the hospital. I became very involved from an organizational standpoint. Over the years became chairman of the Hospital Association of Pennsylvania and became active in the American Hospital Association and became active in a group of Jewish-sponsored hospitals across the country that I chaired. And because of that, much of what was going on in healthcare was happening in Washington, D.C. and in Harrisburg with Medicare and Medicaid. And so in that connection, there were political action committees that were set up. I became a significant fundraiser for the political action committee of the Hospital Association of Pennsylvania, political action committee in Pennsylvania. And there what we were doing was giving political contributions to candidates who would reflect the philosophy of the association. Since hospitals were undergoing significant financial problems. So my political activities were almost totally in conjunction with my job.
I want to get back to one thing. You were in the Navy.
Right.
Was there anything particularly significant that occurred while you were in the Navy?
Well, I was a radioman. I trained at the University of Wisconsin and then went to Chicago and Philadelphia and then was part of a commissioning of a crew. cruiser that went out to the South Pacific. So I was involved in a number of battles that were going on in the South Pacific. I don't think there was anything unusual about that. You know, you go through the surf, you go through or whatever you have to go through when you're in the Navy.
How many years were you in?
I was in about 3 years, and I was in the South Pacific, I guess, for about 15 or 17 months. I'm sure people have told you this before, but I enlisted when I was 17, as soon as I got out of school. And you know, when you're that young, you're immortal. You never think of dying. And so all the time I was in the Navy, it was like one great big vacation for me. Even when there were kamikaze planes diving on our ship and there were all kinds of explosions and we went alongside and put out the fires on an aircraft carrier that had been hit by three kamikazes and took the wounded aboard and buried hundreds of people at sea. And all during that, it was like I was on a vacation. I mean, I just refused to accept the fact that you could be killed because you're immortal when you're young. It's only as you get older. I used to do things in the service that, that today I would never think of doing, like having to climb the masts of ships and string antennas. And when I came home from the service, I couldn't walk across the Shenley Park Bridge and look over the side. I had developed an antipathy to heights. So from my standpoint, there was really nothing unusual about it. I mean, particularly, I wasn't a war hero or anything like that. Anything that ever grew out of all of that was that I met some friends. A couple of them were from Pittsburgh. One of them I still keep in contact with. And a few years ago, I guess it was about 2 years ago, the ship that we put into commission, which was called the Wilkes-Barre, we had a reunion of the ship's crew, because we were the people who had commissioned the ship in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. And my friend from Pittsburgh, who's a fellow by the name of George Hamill of Hamill Quinlan Real Estate, and I got together, and so I just established that relationship. But other than that, in going through the war, nothing in particular. I did have one interesting, again, anecdote that I thought was going to be one of these once-in-a-lifetime events, but it turned out not to be. When the war ended and the ship I was on traveled the coast of China, we were in a city called Tientsin, and the Navy had taken over a hotel. And I walked in and we stayed there when we were on leave. And there was a boutique in the lobby of the hotel. And I noticed that there was clearly a white Russian woman who was behind the boutique, because there were lots of white Russians on the coast of China because they migrated there during the revolution. And so I walked over to this woman, and I had to just tell you the way in which it occurred. I said to her, "You're white Russian, yes?" I said, where are you from? She says, "Oh, I'm from a little town outside Kiev." I said, "That's interesting. My mother was lived in a little town outside Kiev." I said, "What is your name?" She said, "Ostrovsky." My mother's name was Ostrovsky. It was Ostro, reduced from Ostrovsky. I said, "That's very interesting. That was my mother's name." I said, "What is your first name?" And she said to me, "Cecilia." Well, at this point, I thought, my God, is this a long-lost relative? So I took the woman's name and address. And when I got home, I said to my mother, "I have to tell you what happened." And she began to laugh. She says, "Oh, please." She says, "That Ostrovsky in Russia is like Smith in the United States." I thought I had found the long lost trip. But
it was a thrill.
It really was. It was funny.
Yes, it is.
Nothing unusual.
You talked about the anti-Semitism and the things that occurred while you were in the Navy. What were some of the incidents?
Well, when I was in the boot camp at Great Lakes Naval Training Station, I was walking down the street with some fellows who were in my unit. This one fellow was from West Virginia, and he walked over to me and he said, "Let me look at you. I'm going to look at your face. I never saw a Jew before." says, I understand they call them kikes. So, well, you know, he antagonized me, and next thing you know, we were in a fight. An officer came along and stopped us and said, look, if you tell two fellas want to fight, fine, we'll take you down to the gymnasium, you can fight. They took us down to the gymnasium and put us in a boxing ring. I had boxed a little bit before, not very much. And so we got in a fight, and I beat this fellow up and felt very satisfied about the fact that, you know, I kind of got my revenge, so to speak, or satisfaction. When I was on board ship, there were lots of Southerners in the Navy. And they were very, very anti-Semitic. I mean, I recall a fellow from South Carolina, and he would just make repeated anti-Semitic remarks, and the same thing happened. I got so furious one day that I told him if he ever got out of his bunk, I would kill him. I usually lose my temper. But there were repeated instances of direct anti-Semitism, people who would want to beat you up physically. Fortunately, I was able to take care of myself, but the amount of virulent anti-Semitism, both in, in Chicago and Philadelphia on board ship. The interesting thing was, I went to the University of Wisconsin, Madison, Wisconsin. You know, that was the home of Joseph McCarthy, but it was also the home of La Follette. And Madison, Wisconsin was a totally integrated city. And there, everything was very, very open and integrated. And there wasn't, if there was anti-Semitism there, it was not very overt. But it was the only city I was ever in where there wasn't overt anti-Semitism. And that's just the way it was. So it taught me a lesson, because you couldn't hide. And it's interesting. This was a fascinating thing for me. When I got married, my wife, who was very Jewish, and her family was very Jewish, one day out of a clear blue sky said to me, have you thought about changing your name so that it will help you in your professional career? And that just blew my mind, because she was Jewish and her family was Jewish, and I said, why would I want to do that, you know? And she said, I don't want to upset you. I just thought, you know, your name could work against you. I said, I'm either going to make it with the name of Goldberg or I'm not. The irony of all of that is I played basketball at the Y with a fellow whose name is Goldberg. And he changed his name. He changed his name to Shames, George Shames. His family name, I guess, in the old country was Shamus. And so he changed his name to Shames. He's a speech therapist at the University of Pittsburgh. But I had always found that to be very interesting, because she was from such a religious family, but she thought that that would help me in my economic career. I should say, when I was in the hospital field, hospital administrators in the main way,
They were.
Jewish administrators had great difficulty getting jobs excepting in Jewish hospitals. That began to break down as hospitals needed people. Well, it was no different than doctors. You know, doctors were restricted from where they could belong. That was an interesting experience for me, because when I first joined Montefiore Hospital, there was still a quota system in the medical school at the university. It was 6%. And Jewish physicians couldn't get on the staffs of other hospitals. Oh, yes, there was then. Jewish physicians couldn't get on the staff. Jewish surgeons couldn't get on the staff. Even if they got on the staff, they were discriminated against. They never held any significant positions of office. They never had the opportunity to really be treated as equals or to have the same opportunity.
They used to come into McKeesport to try to get staff positions there. Mm-hmm. Many of them did.
And, of course, the hospital was a progressive institution. It broke the color line in this city. It was the place that had trained the first nurses, black nurses, trained the first black physicians.
You're talking about Montefiore.
Montefiore. Provided that kind of an opportunity. One of the nicest things for me about Montefiore Hospital was that it was such a progressive institution, and its philosophy coincided with my own, and I tried to pursue that over the years, so that actually during the 60s, we were the first hospital in the city to put blacks on our board. We had met with McIlvaine, the Father McIlvaine, you recall, and this was during the period of model cities, and we worked out an arrangement whereby we put blacks on the board of the hospital. We had many black physicians on the staff. And to me, that was a very worthwhile experience, because I had always felt that minorities that are discriminated against ought to return the favor for other minorities. And in any event, that was one of the more delightful things, because even at the Hospital Association level in Pennsylvania, it was very anti-Semitic. The hospitals that controlled the association were overwhelmingly small hospitals from rural communities where they never really saw Jews. And they were very, very anti-Semitic, and that was equally true at a national level. Interestingly enough, I may have been the first Jewish president of the Hospital Association of Pennsylvania, and that was not until 1979. And I'm not sure even to this day whether there's ever been a Jewish president of the American Hospital Association. So I guess I live with anti-Semitism, but it was always very satisfying to be able to help break down the barriers. And I was more than happy over the years to help black physicians set up practices, etc., which we have done. And
you had a good relationship with the doctors.
Oh, yeah. Yes, I did. I had a good relationship with the doctors, although we differed on many things. In particular, there was a period of time when we had a very stressful period when we became a medical school hospital that turned off a number of the doctors. But I have to say, through all of that, the only thing that ever allowed me to have a good relationship with the doctors was I was scrupulously honest. I never lied. I knew that if I ever lied and you lost their confidence, you would never get it back. So there were times when I had to say things that didn't make people very happy, but I at least had a good relationship with them, or I couldn't have been in that position as CEO for 28 years.
You were part of Montefiore when the nursing situation changed.
Yes, I was a party to that. If you say the nursing, you mean when we closed the School of Nursing?
Yeah.
Yes, I was. It was one of those national trends. The nursing educators had decided that nursing required a baccalaureate degree. Therefore, they set out to close all of the schools in the United States for a variety of reasons, whether it was for educational purposes, whether it was to limit the supply of nurses and therefore raise salaries, is really unimportant. They established, over the years, two different position papers, which in effect said that you must have a baccalaureate degree to be a professional nurse, and that resulted in many schools of nursing across the country closing. We had affiliations who were providing clinical experiences to the University of Pittsburgh School of Nursing, to Duquesne, to Carlin College, and at one time to Chatham, where they had a program. And it became very clear that with what was going on, you could no longer recruit highly qualified students into a diploma program, that they were going to go into baccalaureate programs. And so we established a task force and had all kinds of people sitting on it, and finally concluded that if we wanted to maintain the quality of the student, we needed to close the school. That's when we closed the school. I guess it was in the late 70s, and and converted the school nurse into a medical office.
And that has been very lucrative for them.
Lucrative, I guess, is the wrong word, because we didn't organize it to the office building, and then we added on to it to make money. Actually, from that standpoint, it wasn't lucrative at all. What it was intended to do was to keep the physicians at the hospital, and that if they had their offices on the premises, they were more likely to admit their patients. It was really an effort to retain the number of patients who were coming to the hospital. But actually, the medical office buildings were established in such a way that the hospital got no profit out of them. They were, for all intents and purposes, like cooperatives or condominiums. But it was really on the basis that if the doctor was at the hospital, he was more likely to use hospital services than to admit patients to the hospital.
I would like to go in to the structure Montefiore Hospital, which obviously was the beginning of a decline, at the time the hospital became university affiliated. What produced that? What was the purpose of it?
Well, let me say that the Montefiore Hospital, when it was created in 1908, was always a teaching hospital. That's been the history of Jewish hospitals across this country, primarily because Jewish physicians want to teach and want to become educated. And I think that's in keeping with the whole rabbinic tradition of the Talmud. When the hospital was created, around the turn of the century, it created a school of nursing, and it had a school of nursing when it was in the Hill District. And then it, up on Center Avenue, Center and Heron. And then it moved to Oakland in 1929. Interestingly enough, when it moved to Oakland, it moved there with the purpose of becoming part of the medical school as far back as then. And ironically, there was a schism in the board 1929. I mean, I've read these minutes when I was a patient in the hospital many years ago. The hospital moved to Oakland to become part of the medical center, and there was a schism in the board. It ruptured, and the hospital was left next to the medical school, but not being a part of the university. But the hospital was still teaching. It had its own training programs for interns, residents, student nurses. It was a teaching hospital. In 1943, my predecessor joined Montefiore, Sidney Bergman, with the expectation that the hospital would become a medical school hospital. And so from 1943 through 1956, he tried to get the hospital affiliated with the medical school. And I must say that at the end of World War II, it was no longer possible to be a good teaching hospital without a medical school affiliation. If you look across this country, every Jewish-sponsored hospital has a close relationship, varying in degrees, to a medical school, because the medical school students are the basis for attracting high-quality interns and residents. And high-quality interns and residents attract high-quality physicians. High-quality physicians want to teach. And the best place to teach and the most challenging place to teach is in a teaching hospital affiliated with a medical school in an open system. And I believe, or I would have never stayed at Montefiore this long, that the best medical care is given in medical school hospitals. I won't disagree that it sometimes is inconvenient, that you get jabbed and pushed by more than the usual number, but if you have anything other than a run-of-the-mill disease, the best place for you to be is in a teaching hospital affiliated with a medical school. In any event, when we talk about anti-Semitism, the leadership in the medical school was anti-Semitic, very specifically. The people who were in charge, McElroy and others, were very anti-Semitic, and that's despite the fact, you know, Jews were on the board of the university, et cetera, et cetera. And they had a quota system in the medical school. In any event, the medical school was reorganized in 1948 by the Mellons. The Mellons reorganized the medical school because it wasn't a good medical school. It was a part-time medical school with voluntary faculty. It was reorganized so that it would become a first-class medical school in the tradition of the Ivy League. I mean, one of the outstanding hospitals in this country is Beth Israel, which is a Harvard hospital, and it became a Harvard Medical School hospital in 1929, right about the time we were hoping to become the same thing. In any event, over the course of roughly 1948 to 1957, they endeavored to reorganize the medical school. They brought in people like McGibney and others, Sergeant Cheever. And in 1957, the medical school brought in a leader in internal medicine, Jack Myers, who was from Harvard, and who, although he sounded Jewish, was not Jewish, but was non-discriminatory as anybody you could name. And so he, Sidney Bergman, who was from Boston and from Beth Israel, he was originally involved in the administration of Beth Israel, went to see Jack Myers to see about getting medical students to come to one of your hospitals. They had never been, the court clerks had never been there. The hospital was still teaching residents, et cetera, et cetera. In any event, medical students began to come to the hospital regularly in 1957 because of Jack Myers. And Jack Myers made it clear that if the hospital were going to continue to get medical students, it would have to reorganize, as all other major teaching hospitals had reorganized, and develop a system of full-time chiefs. Not just full-time pathologists and radiologists and anesthesiologists, but full-time employed physicians in charge of medicine and surgery, department heads. And so when my predecessor retired in 1961, and I took over, we had begun to get medical students on a regular basis, and we initiated the search for full-time department heads. We started looking at surgery. We were not successful. We finally recruited a chief of medicine in 1964. 1969, we recruited a chief in surgery, so that we now had full-time heads in all of the departments.
What were their names?
Dr. Philip Trowan was the chief in medicine. He came from the Beth Israel Hospital in Boston. And the first chief in surgery was Dr. Mark Ravitch, who was an outstanding physician trained at Johns Hopkins, who came to us from the University of Chicago. Both of these gentlemen were Jewish. The issues that arose as a result of taking on full-time department heads and becoming part of a medical school or medical center were primarily issues of the transfer of power, control. Prior to having full-time heads of departments, the voluntary medical staff elected these department heads. And these department heads, in effect, ran medicine and surgery in the hospital. But they had no real binding commitment to the hospital because they had their own agendas and they had their own particular goals. In teaching hospitals, the leadership of the department are full-time people who are accountable to the board, who may practice but who aren't really private practicing physicians, and who are committed to the goals of the institution. It was this reorganization and transfer of power, transfer of the decision-making process, that triggered the struggle that occurred from 1969 to 1973.
End of side two, take one. continued on tape two.
Yeah,